Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In her new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over, today's guest, Caroline Frederickson, gives a voice to millions of people, mostly women, who don't have basic rights at work. Afise earns $75 a week for 3 long days of caring for 3 children in Brooklyn. Charlene has to call her supervisor at Walmart every day to find out what her schedule is, making it very difficult, almost impossible, to plan child care and finances. Beatrice works as a nanny from 7 a.m. to midnight, 7 a.m. to midnight with no breaks. Her employer denies her request for time off. And Shaquanika went back to work a day after having a hysterectomy because she says missing work means her children will not eat. These are just some of the few stories we read about in Under the Bus. While major legislative gains over the years have attempted to create a more even playing field for women in the workforce, millions remain underpaid and unprotected. Caroline Frederickson says this miscarriage of fairness in the law has its roots in slavery and Jim Crow policies that remain unchallenged. Caroline Frederickson is president of the American Constitution Society. She's a senior fellow at Demos and author of the new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. She served as director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America. And Caroline joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Caroline. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's such a pleasure to be on.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you for writing this book. I understand that you first came up with this idea because you were frustrated about the lean-in conversation. And so this came about when Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg started encouraging women to lean in the workplace in order to get ahead. And then she wrote a book by the same name, and now Lean In is just being talked about all over the place.
Well, that's right. And, you know, and let me just start by saying, I think Sheryl Sandberg does add something to, you know, the understanding of what women face. I think there's certainly issues that we all know that we confront about cultural stereotypes and about inhibitions that we internalize about speaking up in meetings and so forth. But really, you know, those aren't the issues that are most existential for the vast majority of women. And there was just this huge media discussion about whether it was leaning in or whether the other often written about phenomenon was opting out, and, you know, whether women would just leave the workforce because they couldn't figure out how to take care of kids and also have a demanding full-time job as a partner in a law firm. And I thought, well, you know, most women actually aren't partners in law firms. Unfortunately, there aren't nearly enough of those. But the fact of the matter is they can't choose. They can't opt out, and they can't lean in, because opting out is just, you know, as you mentioned, many of the stories in the book, the women I talk to illustrate, they have no option. They have to work. They need the money. And, you know, and leaning in, if you're a low-wage worker, is virtually impossible. And sometimes women try it, and all they get out of it is they get fired.
Well, I was struck by the stories that you told in your book, because we often hear about Walmart, for example. You know, you write about Walmart also. Charlene, for example, has to call her supervisor every day to find out what her schedule is, which makes it difficult to plan for childcare. But you also talk about Rihanan Brochat. She lost her job when a snow day closed schools in Chicago. She worked for Whole Foods. She had no option but to stay home to take care of her son, who has special needs. And she's a single mom. She had nowhere to turn. And she hoped that her employer, Whole Foods, would be flexible and humane enough to let her stay home. But you write, no such luck. She had used up her unpaid leave days and was told by her boss not to come back. We don't hear that about Whole Foods. We do about Walmart, but not Whole Foods. Is that common at Whole Foods?
Well, you know, I don't want to speak to Whole Foods specifically. I just say generally, the fact of the matter is Americans are not entitled to, the vast majority of Americans are not entitled to paid sick leave. And so what that means, particularly for parents and for single parents more than anyone who tend to be women, is that they're caught in a total bind. Because what do you do when your child is sick, and what do you do when you're sick? You know, honestly, I think most parents, if they're sick, they just go into work and the rest of us get sick. When their child is sick, they can't really do that, so they have to stay home. And, you know, and I think it's sort of an undiscussed issue in America, is the real lack of child care options for most families. And this isn't even just the low-wage worker. It really goes up the income scale to the middle class, because childcare in this country is both inaccessible, low quality, and unaffordable. And, you know, you see those stories. In fact, I found one about a California situation where a childcare facility was basically they're unregulated, and parents have really so few options to figure out a place that they can leave their child that they can afford. And, you know, the consequences can be really extreme. And in this case, in California, the child care center was shut down finally after many, many, many stories of children being left in dangerous situations. Mm. And in fact, one finally being left in a closet. And, you know, it's just these stories are incredible. And you just don't really think about the fact that this is a cumulative impact, that these are, you know, many, many families in the United States who face these issues, who don't sort of realize that they're common. They all kind of figure out, you know, their own way of coping. And so I would just say, you know, that one of the things I found most shocking in doing my research about childcare was that that the Department of Labor, which tracks with the Department of Health and Human Services levels of, you know, childcare and what the different arrangements are. And, you know, there are all sorts of things. You know, there's private childcare, there's Head Start, there's family members. And then they actually have a category called self-care. And, I, you know, it just makes you shudder when you think about what that says about America, that particularly after the last, you know, recession, there were more and more children in self-care. And that's just the fact that certain parents have to say, you know what, I just have to earn some money to pay the rent, and I have to be able to feed my children, and so I just have to leave them alone. If I can't afford daycare. And that, I think, is just unacceptable.
When you're talking about childcare, you reminded me of a show we did about the amazing documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, which takes a look at what most of us don't know about the feminist movement. And in 1971, the House and Senate passed a comprehensive child care bill, but it was vetoed by President Nixon. And this is not widely known. And I'm so glad we talked about that twice on this show. A lot of people wrote in and said they had never heard of that law.
Well, it's kind of amazing. And the story itself is, it's, you know, almost would make you laugh if the consequences hadn't been so terrible. But, you know, it was Phyllis Schlafly once again, you know, the woman who helped defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. And she had gotten her armies of, you know, of people together who were trying to make sure that, you know, women couldn't actually become full citizens in the United States. And when the child care bill passed, I mean, it was really an amazing phenomenon and really important policy. And she rallied her troops, including a group called the 4 W's, and that stands for Women Who Want to Be Women, who apparently can't work. That would be 5 W's, I guess. And so the women who want to be women didn't want women to work. And so they rallied and, you know, lobbied Congress, and eventually, when they failed in Congress, they lobbied President Nixon through Pat Buchanan, who was working for him at the time, and he got President Nixon to veto the law. And, you know, and the fact of the matter that nobody really knows this, that it was that the law was passed by Congress, that we came so close, and that we haven't even tried since then, I think. And, you know, again, as I said, the consequences are enormous for anybody who really thinks about, you know, what it means for the United States to have a generation of children who are in self-care, let alone low-quality, poorly regulated facilities, and then the kids who aren't in anything at all.
Nixon said it was the most radical piece of legislation to emerge from the 92nd Congress.
Yes. It's just... it's really incredible the things they said. And, you know, Phyllis Schlafly went on and on about how these crazy feminists were going to be stealing our husbands and taking their jobs, and, you know, children would join unions. And, you know, they go on and on about this, you know, sort of how the world was coming to an end, because children would actually have someone to care for them if their mother needed to or wanted to work.
And so here we are, what, 44 years later, and you have just jaw-dropping stories in your book. How, just talk about the process involved in finding these women, and what struck you most about them telling their stories?
Well, first of all, I'd say there's some amazing groups of advocates, including a group in California called Mujeres Unidas, that is based in Oakland, I believe, that was extraordinarily helpful to me, as was the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the Restaurant Opportunity Center, which is also based at Berkeley, where Saru Jayaraman does amazing work, and unions, and any number of other types of groups that, you know, put me in touch with workers, retail workers, home care workers, nannies. I went to a meeting of domestic workers at CASA of Maryland, which works with immigrant families. And in every way, I was had the opportunity to either sit down or talk on the phone with women about their stories. And, you know, what I was really trying to capture was that there is a very large group of women and increasingly more men who are in a category, as you alluded to at the beginning, introducing the book, that aren't protected at all by the law. And in Under the Bus, I really wanted to explore kind of why that had come about and what were the consequences of the exclusions in our protective laws.
You also point out, and this is really important because we get the jobs numbers every month, but if, you know, let's say the Labor Department says 300,000 jobs were created this month, the reporters rarely say, well, what kind of jobs were actually created? And you report in your book, Under the Bus, that a recent study estimates that mid-wage jobs constituted 60% of the jobs lost during the recession in 2008, but only a little more than 20% of those created during the recovery. By contrast, low-wage jobs were 21% of the jobs lost during the recession, but have been close to 60% of the new jobs created post-recession, 60%. So when we hear that 300,000 jobs have been created, 60% of those jobs are low wage.
Absolutely right. And, you know, I think the other part of it is not only are they low wage, but they're often part-time. And, you know, in some ways the recession was an opportunity for employers to kind of shake loose of, you know, their constraints of the employment relationship. And they moved more and more towards independent contractors who have no protections at all. They moved more and more workers to low-wage positions and into part-time. And, you know, we're just not creating those jobs, you know, that have decent benefits anymore because, you know, we haven't organized, I think, enough around the issues to get that done.
And so talk a little bit about, you have a lot of stats in your book, about low-wage workers. You say that women make up 53% of the low-wage economy. Break that down for us.
Well, so women are, I think, you know, one of the facts that gets very little attention when we talk about raising the minimum wage and the fight for 15, which has done great, great work, is that women are two-thirds of minimum wage workers. So right there, you've got, you know, a big reason. Women are also the majority of those who make a little bit above the minimum wage and a little bit below the minimum wage. They're three-quarters of the workers who are in the tipped category, meaning they earn, in most states in this country, $2.13 an hour is their hourly wage. And the assumption is that the tips will somehow bring them up to our current minimum wage, which is already way too low. So those are a couple of the reasons, and women are almost two-thirds of part-time workers. And so all of those things, when you add them up, and then you consider that women are also the vast majority of those who actually don't even earn the minimum wage necessarily because they're not entitled to the minimum wage, they're not entitled to overtime, they're not entitled to protections against discrimination in the payment of wages. For those, once you add those categories together, you have an enormous number of women that fall into the low-wage worker category.
And just to put a number on that, in 2013, almost 17 million women earned less than $11 per hour. Today, I am speaking with Caroline Fredrickson about her new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. In the past couple of weeks, we've done a lot of shows on workers. And so when we found out about Caroline's book, we really wanted to bring her on. We'd love to hear from you. If you're a domestic worker, home health aide, a tipped worker, if you make minimum wage, what is your experience like? What is your work environment like? Have you experienced discrimination at your job? What would happen if you lean in at work? Have you ever tried to ask for time off? What was the outcome of that? And then what can be done to change these policies? There's so much work, as Caroline said, around the fight for 15. But what else? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Caroline, you also have some really interesting information in your book about history and how we got here. You say that this miscarriage of fairness in the law has its roots in slavery and Jim Crow policies that remain unchallenged to this day. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I think so. I spent a lot of time. I mean, I live in D.C. now. I work in D.C. But before I left politics, which I did for quite a number of years, to go to the ACLU, I worked in the Senate. I worked in the Clinton White House, and I had my hands in, involved in a lot of legislative work. And so, I started. I actually drafted a few bills, one of which. One of which is law, one, the Paycheck Fairness Act, which is, lingering, still comes up periodically. But, what we do in, generally when you're trying to pass a law, you use something that's a kind of already existing law and you amend it. You're taking something that people know and you say you're just making a tweak. All of these, the work that I did was primarily in the area of labor and employment, as well as kind of judiciary issues, reproductive rights, civil rights, and so forth. But you take the existing civil rights laws or the existing labor laws and you tweak them. And they all have these exemptions. And, I never really thought about why is it that we leave out all these numbers of different kinds of workers from the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the minimum wage and overtime bill. And it affects different categories differently, like farm workers, not entitled to overtime. They finally got minimum wage. Domestic workers, who are finally coming into the right to have minimum wage and overtime, were left out for 80 years. We have, taxi drivers and a variety of others. And then in our civil rights laws, we leave out employers with fewer than 15. And some states and localities are doing better than that, but that's the national law. And so when I was doing the research for Under the Bus, I started, thinking, what were the origins of us deciding we don't want to protect domestic workers and farm workers? We don't want to, protect for a certain period of time. People who worked in laundries weren't protected. I think in California that might resonate, why it was that that category of workers at a time when Asian Americans were very discriminated against, why they might have been left out of the law. And so, to getting back to the origins of these laws, which, started really in the New Deal, and President Roosevelt, is due, of course, an enormous amount of credit for pushing them through. But, he made compromises, and he had he was dealing with the what are termed the Dixiecrats, members of Congress from the South who really had a strong interest in protecting what remained of the slave economy, the plantation system, which was still fairly much in place. They wanted to make sure that those workers who were primarily African American in the South, and I think agribusiness in the West was interested in excluding a population that was growing in terms of Latinos. And what they did was they just carved them out. They said, those people who work on my plantation, who pick my cotton, who take care of my children, who cook my food, who clean my house, we don't want them to have any part of a minimum wage. We don't want them to be able to join a union. They're never going to get overtime. That was sort of what it came out of. But, I think it maybe if some of your readers decide to read the book, they will find some extensive quotations from the congressional record of the time. But even though you know that that's what it was like, it's still shocking to read members of Congress say on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate what their intentions were in trying to carve out these groups of workers. And they were very explicit, about how it was that it just wasn't right to have black folks be treated the same, and it wouldn't go where we need to protect the one of them talks about the great legacy of the Confederacy it's a shock and it's astonishing. But the fact that's most shocking to me really is that we haven't fixed it. It's one thing that happened in the 30s. But it's another thing that the legacy of these laws continues to have an impact on people today.
Well, and you were a special assistant to President Clinton for legislative affairs.
Yes.
And so I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on his welfare reform, because University of Minnesota sociologist Joe Soss spent about a decade studying it. His book, Disciplining the Poor, Neoliberal Paternalism and the Persistent Power of Race, looks at how that bill ultimately led to a system that's rife with racial bias, because race became a determining factor in how states created their welfare programs.
Well, it's very true, and I think actually, it's a huge disappointment. I went into the Clinton administration at the very last, at the end. I just got out of law school at that point. And it shocked me then. It shocks me more now, actually, in retrospect, especially, you know, when you put it back to back with what we were just talking about, which was the child care legislation that President Nixon vetoed at the behest of those who were fighting the ERA and fighting women's emancipation. And then you look at sort of the dialogue around women, mothers, and families around that particular piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. And the framing is clearly these are white women and these are white families. And it's sort of this ideal of leave it to Beaver. You know, we have this perfect family. Dad goes to work with his briefcase. You have 3.5 kids. Mom wears an apron. She stays at home baking. She cleans the house. All is good. You know, we all go to church. And that was sort of that image. And when you get into the discussion around welfare reform, the idea that those mothers would stay at home was outrageous to people. And they talk about welfare queens, and they talk about they're lazy, and how could they possibly stay at home? And so, you know, what I think is really incredibly striking is contrasting those two debates and thinking about what our image of family and mothering is when you look at actually the racial aspect. And, you know, women of color are expected to work. They're expected to be out. They're not expected to be staying home because their families aren't respected in the same way, and their parental care isn't respected in the same way. And so as a result, the welfare reform bill basically just pushed women into the workforce, took away any support they had, but didn't give them the sustaining the sustenance they needed in terms of child care. Back to child care. There was no child care. There was almost nothing in terms of transportation money, education, job training, learning about how to apply for jobs, finding out where they are. I mean, none of that was very little of that was actually in the law, and none of it practically was funded, even to the point where you have some of the right-wing architects who've backed away from it because they recognize that it is and they come from a very conservative perspective that is actually very anti-family, and it's very destructive to children to expect their mothers to be working at some low-wage job and not have any kind of child care for them. And, you know, I think for those of the listeners who, you know, were paying attention to the news of maybe 6 months or so ago, maybe it was a little longer, there was a story about a mother who worked at McDonald's. And, you know, McDonald's sort of notorious low-wage employer. She was a North Carolina African-American mother and, you know, really trying to do her best to take care of her kids. But clearly, on a minimum wage, you cannot afford child care in this country where the average cost is the same as in-state college tuition. So just imagine that as a low-wage worker. You don't even make that much money a year, let alone can pay it out in child care. So she basically left her child in the park across the street from the McDonald's. She checked on her. I think she had coworkers go and check on her child. And then, you know, somebody calls the police, and they come in, and she gets, you know, arrested for child neglect and whatnot. And this happens to families all over the country where they're trying their best, but, you know, because they can't actually meet that standard because it's unaffordable and not provided for them, you know, they get into situations where children get taken away from them, or they end up, in some kind of, they're arrested. And then
and hold that thought, Caroline. We have to take a quick break. Today I'm speaking with Caroline Frederickson, author of the new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of Local Public Radio, and Kevin Vance and I just taking 2 minutes during this break in your call to ask for your support. We are endeavoring to end our September membership campaign tomorrow at 6 p.m., and we want you to help us make it to our goal so we can say, yes, we want to support programming like Your Call, which is supported entirely by KALW listeners, to continue and be strong.
KALW 91.7, that's 800-525-9917 is our telephone number. KALW.org is our website. Ask for a copy of Under the Bus. Caroline Frederickson, our guest here on Your Call, available for a $120 pledge to KALW. That's $5 a month. That can be sustaining for KALW. 800-525-9917, KALW.
800-525-9917. This conversation that Rose and Caroline Frederickson are having is very much in line with the kind of programming you hear on Your Call on a regular basis, paying attention to the realities of women in the world, to the realities of work, and not just the Sheryl Sandbergs of the world, right? Not the stories that get told over and over again, but the stories of women and workers who are in much more difficult situations, who don't have the kind of choices, but for whom organized labor, for whom workers' rights and protections by the government are all the more important. That's the conversation that you keep going when you make a call to 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Under the bus, yours for a $120 contribution, but at every level of support, you'll keep KALW strong and make sure your call is here into the future.
800-525-9917, KALW.org. Stories that make you furious, but also stories that give you hope that people are doing something, that we can do something. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. And thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson about her new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Caroline is president of the American Constitution Society and a senior fellow at Demos. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Caroline about the research that she's done, she interviewed so many women working at Walmart. We've got stories even about unionized women who were working at the 911 system in New York, and I'll ask her about that in just a couple of minutes. But if you'd like to share your story, if you make minimum wage or don't have specific hours, talk about what that is like. We'd love to hear from you. If you have leaned in at work asking for a raise or for more time off, what was the response? What do you think about this whole lean-in conversation? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have an email from Annie. She says, I have worked in the garden landscape industry for over 20 years, starting at a soil and rock yard in the 90s. I have since stepped into a more entrepreneurial role of being sole proprietor of my business. While I struggle to find good legal helpers, I have been paying $15 to start. I'm working on legitimizing my company, further paying for insurance, W-2s. It's a huge learning curve. I went into the soil and rock yard the other day and was shocked to find that they still start people at less than $12 an hour, the same as they started people back in the 90s. Hmm. What are your thoughts on that, Carolyn? And
well, that's definitely, you know, those are there are industries that are kind of rife with situations of, you know, actually much worse than that story of having a whole group of contractors or using day laborers. I mean, the sort of the issue around the gardening and construction, landscaping often uses those kind of workers who really are kind of just on day to day trying to figure out where they're going to be employed. It's also very common in the house cleaning business. Or you know, the other thing that goes along with a lot of these businesses is they're quite small. Oftentimes, and stay small, perhaps on purposefully, because if you stay under a certain number, under the national law, it's 15. You're exempted from civil rights laws, so you can discriminate. You can discriminate in wages. You can discriminate in benefits. That certainly affects people of color quite a bit, and women. And there are interesting, deplorable statistics that show that, in fact, small businesses employ fewer women and minorities, and the pay is lower.
Well, thank you for writing in, Annie, and you can write us at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What will it take to change the situation that so many workers, low-wage workers, specifically women, are facing on a regular basis? Talk a little bit about the categories of workers that are excluded from basic protections.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, there are a number of different laws, and so some workers are excluded from almost all of them, some workers from others, and some workers from all of them completely. And so the workers who are excluded in many ways are, as I mentioned, I think one of the big categories are domestic workers. When the law was passed, you know, that was maids, nannies, house cleaners. But it's become an incredibly large industry now because I think, as we all know, we have an aging population in the United States. There are a lot of people who either work directly for a company and take care of elderly and disabled people in their houses, or they work, they're paid by Medicaid. And it's just in a booming industry that's quite profitable. And so what has not changed, though, is that the color of the faces of most of the women who do these jobs remain darker. many of the workers are immigrant women, and they are fighting desperately now to get their minimum wage and overtime, and President Obama has made a real effort to get that accomplished. Farm workers are also excluded from the overtime law, and for a long time, as I mentioned, they were excluded from minimum wage as well. They cannot bargain collectively in any part of the United States except in California. The National Labor Relations Act, which is the bargaining law which allows people to join a union or act collectively, also excludes domestic workers, taxi drivers. There are a whole litany of different small groups that were the subject of a variety of lobbying campaigns from industries during the New Deal in the 40s, and by and large, none of that's been fixed. And you know, as many listeners are very familiar in California with the fight that's been going on with Uber and with Lyft over whether or not their employees are employees or contractors, and as contractors not entitled to any of the benefits that employees get, including such things as unemployment insurance. What remains true, unfortunately, is that taxi drivers have always been treated that way because they were excluded from the law from the beginning. So you have these categories, but then I think the other piece that's really important to this discussion is the independent contractor piece. I mean, one of the reasons that companies like Uber and Lyft are interested in having their workforce categorized as independent contractors is because they don't have to give them any benefits. They're not liable to all sorts of different kinds of protections that the law requires. And so the incentive is incredibly strong to basically offload the risk of employment to the worker and to the state and to the taxpayer, honestly, because in many cases you'll find that these low-wage workers are, because of they're exempted from all these programs, are much more dependent on government programs, on food stamps or mm-hmm. other types of aid. And so with the independent contractor issue, which I think has been a long-standing one as a kind of a clever way of offloading risk, that is a very much growing sector now. And then when you look at all the other the categories of workers who are exempted from this or that or the other thing, their estimates are saying that, there's going to be up to 40% of the American workforce soon that is going to be in one of those categories not too long from now.
Wow. That's a huge number, 40%.
It's incredible.
Where do you see that going?
Well, there's been an important conversation that's been initiated people start to recognize that the sort of fragile protections that took so long to build, or even those that exist for those workers who are actually protected, are coming unraveled. The idea that we have this, as you mentioned, Walmart uses just-in-time scheduling where workers have to call in every day and find out whether they actually have a shift that day. A lot of retail has been using that. The fact that we don't have child care, that 90% of them of American workers don't have paid family leave, so when they have a childbirth or a family medical emergency, they can't take paid time off, and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, you realize that we are a nation of contingency. We have this incredible contingent situation where people are always sort of on the edge of disaster. And so, what's happened, I think, is everybody, there are a certain number of people, and I give credit to Senator Warner from Virginia, who is not known as the most progressive, sort of labor-friendly senator, kind of a new Democrat kind of senator. But he has been looking at the so-called sharing economy, recognizes that there needs to be kind of a new way of constructing benefits. SEIU and its leadership have beginning to look at these issues. The other unions, AFL-CIO unions, have been engaged in this conversation. But the idea is, we actually, the independent contractor situation is in part created by the fact that it's a perverse incentive, right? When you hang benefits on an employee-employer relationship, and the sort of, you know, it's a 19th century construct. There is a lot of interest that employers have to get out of that employer-employee relationship and broaden the category of workers that are designated as contractors. It's very financially effective for the company. So, you know, we need to start thinking about how do we unbundle that, right? What are the ways of providing more universal benefits or portable benefits? The state of California, for example, has a paid family leave program, and they do it through a mechanism of shared risk and insurance kind of policy. And so it doesn't depend on your being at one employer for a certain length of time, unlike the Family and Medical Leave Act, which is the national law, which provides only unpaid leave, and even if that, for a small category of workers because of all sorts of exemptions. But the California system means that you take it with you as you go. You've paid into it. It's a sort of payroll tax deduction. Several other states, not enough right now, it's only five or six, have a similar system. So we need to start thinking about how do we provide a new sort of package of benefits to ensure that children are cared for, that people who are sick aren't in the workforce, that we have a reasonable ability to combine work and family, that we accept that the work sort of nature of work is changing, that people tend to change jobs more often, that there may be more flexibility in their arrangements. You know, and when you start thinking about all those things together, it's not necessarily bad that there's more flexibility. I mean, that could be good for some people and in some situations, but you have to kind of to think about the person who thinks it's great, the young person who's writing blogs in a Starbucks and using free Wi-Fi, can sort of scrape together enough to pay the rent. 20 or 30 years from now, that person might have kids, that person might be thinking about retirement, and there's going to be nothing there. And so we need to start thinking about, those people who aren't sort of thinking seriously about the consequences.
Well, right, and I was sitting next to a young woman yesterday. She's so excited, just got a job living in San Francisco. She's paying $2,600 a month for a studio and has no money to, have fun with or go out to dinner with. We're talking today with Caroline Fredrickson, author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Speaking of California, we have a caller on the line who wants to ask you about the women who are representing California citizens in Washington. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose and guests. This is really an important subject. It seems like forever we've had three women representing the Bay Area and California in Congress in very powerful positions, especially Congresswoman Pelosi as the Speaker of the House. I've been personally very disappointed in them in regards to the continuation of the very, very expensive military-industrial complex. But I was wondering whether or not, what your guest's opinion was concerning these very powerful women and the contributions that they've made or not made in regards to helping working women.
Thank you, John. Caroline, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a great question.
Yeah.
I think one of the sad things about the whole context is that how few women there really are in Congress. And, sometimes you see this sort of congratulatory coverage of the election saying, we now have 20 women in the Senate. And I think, well, that's 20%. That's really pathetic. And I don't even think we reach that number overall when you add the House. I'm not sure of the latest numbers. When I was actually chief of staff to a woman senator, Maria Cantwell from Washington State. And I don't know if I want to reflect specifically on the California members. I think they've actually done a lot more than most. They have engaged on issues around women in work. I think there's a lot more focus on it now. They're especially some of the younger women are getting into the issues of flexible scheduling, getting advance notice if your employer is going to change your schedule, looking at minimum wage increases that get rid of the tipped minimum wage, looking at paid family leave that are becoming much more of the major conversation. I think the women of California, the three we're talking about, are there others? Senators Boxer and Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi are incredibly important symbols, but we just need more than symbols. And so I think caller's name was John.
Yes.
John, I think you're absolutely right. they need to be doing more. They need to be speaking up more. But I think, you know, what I think we need to do is we need more women. We need more diversity. But we primarily, those of us who care about these issues, need to push them. Because I am seeing action. There's a lot of action at the state level. But there are a lot more bills in the hopper right now on these issues than there ever have been in Congress. And that's because people out in the community and people like you are actually raising your voices and saying, you know, enough is enough. You know, we want to actually live fulfilling, decent lives and be able to feed our children and pay the rent without working 90-hour weeks and never being able to have a day off when we're sick.
Well, can you give us some insight? Because I think people are frustrated because they don't hear enough politicians raising hell about these issues. And I think people are, you know, excited about a Bernie Sanders because he is. I mean, he's talking about inequality. He's talking about all the issues that we're talking about here. And a lot of people are saying, you know, why is it that so few politicians actually speak with authority and speak with passion about these issues?
No, it's absolutely true. And I do think that that is a lot about, you know, about what is behind Bernie Sanders' surge. I think Hillary Clinton has actually been pretty good on these particular issues, but she doesn't talk about it in a way that reaches people. I think she's had a lot of legislation that she's headed up that I think has been important, and her policies right now are very good. I think what we need is to see the same energy and passion that we have as advocates reflected in our leaders. And to me, though, that really only happens upward. You know, it's a grassroots upward push, and I hope the people who are listening to your wonderful show will understand that members of Congress are essentially, they're not going to do the right thing unless you make them do it. And I think there are a lot of forces on the other side. The money in politics situation is abhorrent. It's disgusting how much influence a dollar has, and $1 million has even more, and, you know, $1 billion, well, that basically owns Congress. So I think we need to understand the only thing that we can do to counter that is mobilize. And that's why I am more optimistic, because where that is happening at the state level, you know, for example, in California, where you've passed a number of good pieces of legislation around domestic workers, a domestic workers' bill of rights, the number of other states that have been passing paid sick leave bills, there have been efforts, as I mentioned, to provide different types of portable benefits for workers. And so I think but that only happens. We can't look up and expect them to do it. We actually have to make them do it. And if that means changing who they are, then that means changing who they are. But I think with the case of the senators and Speaker Pelosi, Mrs. Pelosi, I think what's most important in this case is that they've really been pretty good, but we need them to be better, and we need them to be better, and the best way to make them be better is to push on them and add more of them.
Caroline Frederickson is author of the new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over, and you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Philip wrote in to respond to Annie's question about being shocked to find that landscapers are still they start people at less than $12 an hour, which is what they started people at in the 90s. Philip writes, you mentioned that the employer was surprised that rock yard workers were paid a mere $12 an hour. You might like to know that entry-level dialysis workers start at $13 an hour in a major corporation. This is right here in San Mateo County, not Arkansas. In addition, new applicants are expected to have spent thousands of dollars at a technical training school unless you have prior experience in the field.
Well, you know, this is just another aspect of our low-wage workforce. It's starting to touch the professions. Mm. One of the, you know, really interesting issues that I've been writing about recently is adjunct professors. And so we think of, you know, wow, those are really the professionals. These are people with advanced degrees. They're teaching at universities and colleges. They're teaching most of the children of the people who are listening to this program who have kids in college. 75% of the teaching workforce now in higher education is adjuncts. So they're lucky if they even have a short-term contract, and they make those kind of dollars. You know, it's an abysmal pay. And so even the professional class, those people who've gone and achieved, you know, whether it's an advanced degree or a professional certificate or some other kind of special training, it's not panning out anymore in terms of even a middle class lifestyle. And you know, I think that's why all these other things become even that much more important. If you can't pay for childcare, if we don't have a childcare system that's affordable, you know, those people take a double and triple hit.
Yeah, well, thank you for the email, Philip. We have another email from Lisa who says, my sister and stepmom work at Sports Chalet and Supercuts. They have their weekly schedules last minute and sometimes get called the very same day to cancel their shifts. Is there legislation to rectify this?
There is, in fact, pending. You know, we'll see. I mean, I don't think this Republican Congress is going to do anything about it. But in certain New York City and I think in San Francisco have both adopted different types of regulations on scheduling that would include, and I'm not specific on all of the details of each piece of legislation, but things like, you know, if you call in and your shift is canceled at the last minute, you get a full day's pay. If you get sent home early, getting your schedule at least a week or 2 weeks in advance, you know, it hardly seems like you know, something that would break a corporation to actually let its workers know when they were supposed to report to work. You know, it's a phenomenon that is puzzling in many ways, and I think it seems more cruel than actually cost conscious. I mean, I was sort of struck by the fact that about a month or so ago, there was news that Victoria's Secret, under pressure, and I think there was a lawsuit in California, had decided to stop its on-call or on-demand scheduling, which is that kind of idea where you call in every day and you only know that day whether lingerie needs to be sold. And I just thought, how much can it really vary day to day, you know, whether there are going to be lacy bras for sale? I mean, how different is that demand on a Tuesday versus a Wednesday? And, you know, it doesn't seem like there's any, you know, it's some manager went to some school, you know, some class that taught them about efficiencies, and they thought, well, we can apply what we applied to a car plant, just-in-time building of cars, you know, in terms of car parts. We can just apply that to our entire workforce and not even thinking about what the consequences are for human beings.
Caroline, we have about a minute left. And GS in San Leandro, I don't have time to take your call, but he says we need an equal rights amendment to the Constitution. He says Bernie Sanders can do it. In our remaining minute, I wanted to ask you, you've got a lot of industries that are lobbying to keep the status quo, right, the way it is, low wages, no paid time off. We're going to change your schedule tomorrow and you've got to deal with it. So given that, what do you think is most effective in trying to fight back? And then what are your top two policy changes?
Well, I think the most effective thing in fighting back really is organizing because, you know, there are advances going on at the state level. I'm not expecting major changes in national legislation until we have, you know, another president who's hopefully not going to be Trump. You know, and when that happens, we'll have more opportunities and a new Congress. But at the state and local level, there have been a lot of advances. So, I think for me overall, I think the most important thing that we really need is childcare, because I think about the cost for families, the impact on children, and the ability of particularly women, but not just women, to actually work and have a satisfying career without always worrying about what's going on at the unsupervised, unregulated childcare facility that they were able to afford. So, you know, for me, I think that's really one of the absolute most important things that we need as a society for women, for children, for families, for men, for our economy, essentially. And beyond that, I think we do really need to reconstruct our system of benefits so that they are not they don't allow employers to fuss around with the employer-employee relationship and make more and more workers independent contractors, but actually people have some entitlement to health care, retirement benefits, a decent wage, and protection against discrimination.
Caroline Fredrickson is author of the book Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.